2022 is a good reminder, I think, to everyone and all business leaders and finance leaders that times are not always going to be so good, right? Companies are not always going to be so flush with cash. But now, more so than ever, there are these reminders from investors and from the markets, right? That, hey, you know, each dollar actually does matter.
Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp. Join us for in-depth, thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song. Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp, where we host thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song. In each episode, we will dive deep into how the recession may impact different parts of your business, whether it's marketing, sales, tech, e-commerce, and of course, finance and the office of the CFO. Listen right through to the end of each episode to learn about the guests we'll be bringing on throughout the season. Kimya, great to see you. It's been really awesome working with you for the last year plus or so, and it's really great to have you on the podcast.
Alex, excited to dive in. It's been a pleasure working with you as well. I think we have a ton to talk about, so it's going to be a good way to kick off the recession-proof season.
Very cool. And also, it turns out that the two of us probably comprise something like the core of the Miami contingent. We're practically neighbors, actually, down in South Florida.
That is very true. Hopefully seeing more of you in person when our office opens up in the next couple of weeks, depending on when this podcast is released.
That'd be awesome. So here we go. So for our listeners, it would be great if you could spend a few minutes discussing your background, what led you to Buyer, and then subsequently Ramp. I think that would be a really interesting story.
Yeah, happy to. So I've been an entrepreneur and started a few different companies. Topically and most recently, I started a company called Buyer, which was essentially a data company backed by services. What we've done is we've rolled all that data into the buying process, and then we actually act as your on-demand procurement team again. And so over the last year, we've sort of built this out internally. And so it's been a wild ride, I'll say that. It's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun in saving our customers, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's great. It's been a great time.
It's a funny story. I'm actually kind of curious, how did we even find you? You know, a small, right? At the time, I think I remember we were maybe about 120 employees, if even that.
80.
Right? Yeah. And we were based in New York, had a tiny little office. I still remember it, right? And you guys, I think, were a few folks based in Canada, right? So how was that, you know, match made in heaven? Like, how did that occur?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the background on the story is Ramp, when we first launched, so we did a bunch of behind the scenes just to you know, prove the concept, build the database, make sure that we're delivering a ton of value to our customers. And when we publicly launched, Emily reached out from Ramp. And I saw this company. I was like, oh, hot fintech. They would make a great customer. I bet they're overspending like crazy. I bet there's a ton of value we can provide. Little did I realize how much value we could provide. And so Emily reaches out and she says, hey, you know, we're interested to learn more. And so I'm going through this as a sales motion, right? And Ramp's whole pitch, and this is for those who know, this is a sort of repetition, but for those who don't know, is the only financial suite that helps businesses save money. And so the interest and what we were actually driving to was very aligned. And so what we did was we actually started off as a partnership where there weren't at the time, there weren't a lot of like core savings businesses. There were some on the fringe, but you know, there was us, there was Vendor, and then maybe a few others on the like optimization AWS side. And so started off as a partnership, piloted it with the small amount of customers compared to now at the time. That went really well. We saved the customers a bunch of money. And then I'll skip over some of the details and we can dive into the specifics. But basically, Emily was, I'm sure there were conversations in the background. And Emily basically broached the conversation, have you thought about an acquisition? And we were growing so fast at the time that we hadn't. And so I thought about it. And obviously I said yes, because it's been over a year since I've been here.
Very cool. And for our listeners who don't know, Emily was and still is currently the leader of our product partnerships team, and has been instrumental in, you know, helping us secure a lot of our partner rewards, et cetera, a lot of the stuff that you see on ramp.com. That's super cool. I actually want to dive into, first of all, just the procurement kind of business and the nitty gritty of it. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the macro economy, right? And kind of what we're hearing from customers. But one question before we actually get into all of that, which is, you know, the buyer business, which is, you know, now Ramp Savings, right? I think I kind of know what it works, right? Just how it works, just because, you know, I lead a finance team myself. Procurement is obviously very top of mind for me. But it sounds to me like in order for, you know, Ramp Savings to work and really work well, you need two things, right? I want to hear this from you, actually. But one, I think like you need good pricing benchmarks, right? You need a lot of transactional data that you can trust, so that you can actually go and be confident in your negotiations. And two, I think you just need a team of really good negotiators, right? Who do this day in and day out, and they're extremely experienced. What else would you need to build, you know, a great business?
Even backing up on that, I think the core of it is you have to care about your costs, right? And we can talk about this on the macro side, but everyone says they care, but not everyone actually cares. Everyone says, of course, we want to save. And the really big thing that where Buyer really excelled is just like the blocking and tackling of the constant barrage of renewals as your organization expands and contracts and changes, right? And that starts with transparency and visibility into your spend. Oftentimes when we'll drop into companies, you know, pre-ramp, their contracts were in drive somewhere. They didn't really understand how their pricing broke down over here. And it's just a mess, right? And so the first thing is really visibility. Where are you spending? Then it's the benchmarks, right? Because you can go into a negotiation, exactly like you said, where you can say, I want to pay a dollar for my $1 million Salesforce instance. And Salesforce is going to say, no way. Like, of course not, right? And so you need a realistic benchmark. You need the quantitative, and you also need the qualitative, right? So in the negotiation, why should Salesforce, HubSpot, insert tech company here, work with you on your company? They're obviously incredibly smart. They've done this a million times. They have their pricing down to a science. And if companies are getting a lower price here and you are getting a higher price here, you need to understand how to bridge that gap. And that's often both a quantitative and a qualitative discussion, right? And then the other piece is just the blocking and the tackling of the actual conversations, right? To fully automate this, it is a challenge, both because, as you'd understand this better than anyone, finance leaders are incredibly busy. To tackle your $50,000, $25,000 contracts is sort of I don't want to say a waste of time, but there are, you know, you have $9 million contracts that you need to go tackle. Why would you tackle the tail end spend? And then to hire someone on to make sure they're a good negotiator, but who is also doing a lot of other tasks is really a challenge. And so just dedicating the time to it, and also the timing of it too, right? Getting ahead, making sure you have the visibility into when that renewal is coming up. Sometimes contracts have, you know, a 30, 60, 90 day auto renew. And so if you're not reaching out 4 months in advance, it's automatically renewed. And then that spend is just gone. So I think like as a business, really it backs out to how set up are you? How much visibility do you have? And then do you have the pricing benchmarks? Do you actually have the bandwidth to go tackle this? And I think, you know, going into in the years to come, I would say the music probably still is playing. It probably hasn't stopped yet. And a lot of companies haven't felt the pinch. And when they do, this is going to become a priority. And they're really going to think about how to save.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, let's talk, you know, maybe about your view of the procurement business, right? And kind of the underlying demand here. So, you know, let's pretend I know nothing, right? Let's pretend we hadn't met, right? And let's pretend I was just a, you know, archetypal finance leader, right? I work at Ramp, and let's say we've got, you know, a couple hundred, 300 to 400 employees, right? We've got a, you know, a fairly lean finance team. What am I the archetypal, you know, customer for this? You know, at what point in time is it right to bring in procurement or to centralize it, professionalize it, and potentially bring you guys in? And for context, right, there are folks who are listening to this podcast who are probably very, very early stage, very small startups, all the way up to large public companies. I know we also have some investors who, you know, listen as well. So you have a mix of investors and operators. I mean, help us contextualize, you know, you know, am I the right fit? I guess is the question.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the challenge, I would break it out into two buckets. The first is when to professionalize a procurement function within your organization. And then the other is, you know, how do I know if I'm a good fit for a service? And then there's some middle gap in between, right? And so I think spending time on the what signals do I need to watch out for to really make sure that I know I need to bring in a procurement team. The challenge is you always act too late, right? And I think the core function at its essence of a procurement, a great procurement leader is strict cost controls. The balance with a small, rapid, nimble team is you do not want someone telling you, we need 3 months to negotiate this contract. We need this yesterday because we need to run 17 tests that's going to improve our ROI. And so that balance is a tricky one, and it's going to depend on the organization. What I would say is, and it sounds so simple, but it's not simplistic, is really ensuring that all of your team has ownership mentality and treating it as if it's their own money, right? And so do we actually need this spend? Do we need all the features on this? Who actually needs to approve this? And then after they've done that, then it's, you know, there is a tipping point. I would say a classic benchmark is if you're around 150,000 to 200K in annual SaaS spend, you should start thinking about operationalizing your procurement. Because at that tipping point, your business is now big enough where your spend is really going to start to explode, because it's really a slope up. There are services, obviously Buyer is one of these, and this is why our business grows so fast, is there is still a long slope up to where you need a procurement manager. The beauty of this is if you have an on-demand procurement team, you can get 80% of the benefits with 20% of the actual effort. Because you have this team who can drop in, and not shilling Buyer, obviously, but just to illustrate, you can really have this professional team drop in, manage your renewals, manage your contracts, build that professionalization. And then once you're around the, you know, 3 to 5, maybe 7 million in spend, I'd say 7 is probably a bit high, then I would really encourage starting to look for an actual procurement manager. The challenge too is visibility. We have this challenge at Ramp, right? Where there is just so much spend fragmented across the organization. It's lucky for us that obviously our product solves this core challenge. And so it's very easy for us to just suck in all the data. But really having the base of visibility, okay, we've spent this, it's here, we can see it, we know when the renewal is coming up. You either need some on-demand team and then some manager to have this. If you don't have this past 3 million in spend, it's going to get way worse. Tackling this problem early is going to be helpful. And then on the other side, on the, like, how do I think about a procurement team in an organization? I think it's really when you have core large contracts that really need time and attention and are critical to the business. We have a few vendors who we rely very heavily on for our end customer experience. Those commercial terms and the SLAs, those really matter. There's this very long tail that you can hand off. But I think that's another telltale sign of, okay, there are these things that I no longer have time to deal with as a finance leader because I'm working on the actual operations, but it is core to our business and the actual service. And so I really need to think about building out a procurement organization. And then on the long tail of stuff, work with a team, because you're going to get economies of scale in this on-demand fashion where whatever the headcount will cost you, this will cost you 4x less with, again, 80% of the results while spending 20% of the money.
And for now, it seems like is your focus predominantly on subscription-based technology services and SaaS, or does it also encompass, you know, other commercial agreements and whatnot?
We've found the core customer draw, what our customers are really asking for, is help in taming the proliferation of SaaS spend. I think the reason why that is because if you're looking at a services contract, you sort of see it, you interact with it, right? If there is some on-demand infrastructure service, again, it's very core to the nature of what you're trying to build. On SaaS spend, it's a little bit different. You might have your organization grow by 20%, you've got all these seats, and then you contract by 10%. What happens to these orphan seats, right? And then on the other side, there's all, and I'm sure, you know, I'm actually curious if you see this, where there's always back-channeling going on. Hey, WhatsApp group, how much are you paying for Salesforce?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Is this the right price? How do I negotiate this, right? Because I think there's a lot of just newness in all this, and people aren't equipped to deal with it. And so I think the core of it is really around SaaS just because of the lack of transparency and visibility. Oftentimes it's, you know, price to budget. Well, there's no real method to the madness. And so making sure that there's this actual, okay, well, we understand where our benchmarks lie. I mean, in shipping, like this has existed for years. To just pull a quote out of thin air on shipping is sort of insane. And so the fact that it's sort of commonplace in SaaS is quite surprising to me. And that's part of what we're trying to fight.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, right? You have the perfect storm, and which, by the way, is why SaaS is a phenomenal sector to invest in, right? Because you have a perfect storm where pricing is very opaque, right? Which is awesome if you're the seller, not great if you're the buyer, right? That's one. And two is oftentimes the service itself is mission critical, right? If it was Google Cloud or AWS or Salesforce or Cloudflare, whatever it might be, right? It's mission critical. So you're like, how much leverage do I actually have to negotiate? Because I'm going to buy it. Like, let's face it, I'm going to buy this anyways, right? So I think those two combined creates this perfect confluence where I think probably most businesses, right? Most SMBs, mid-market, probably even enterprises, right? Are in this weird position where it's like, I don't know how hard I can negotiate. Right, because it's mission critical, which is where, you know, you and, you know, your team comes in. That's really cool. I think this is really cool.
Yeah. I will say as well, I think the other thing too is there's often this sort of stigma around negotiation where it's, you know, used car salesmen get the best price. It really isn't like that. And to your point on the mission criticality, if you're like, hey, look, we're ripping out Cloudflare, they're like, okay. Where are you going to go?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's not like that. It's really the combination of, we understand there's a lower price. We want to be partners for the long term. Help, like, let's work together on this to be business partners for the long term. I mean, to go to your like Red Seal carpenter who's building your deck and just grind them on price is probably not that safe if you have your kid running around on your balcony, right? Like,
right.
You really want to treat them well. And I think this analogy really extends to all these contracts and these mission critical infrastructure pieces. But there's a lot of SaaS that isn't mission critical. I mean, your whiteboard software that's charging you $4,000 extra a month for SSO, like that's insane.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But I'm curious, I want to flip the question back on you. As the pre and the post, like of buyer, I guess, and experiencing the service, like where have you seen the extension of that for companies that might need this, given that you've experienced the core savings firsthand?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the biggest thing that I personally experienced with you guys, your team, right, the folks who now comprise, you know, the savings team, is it enforces a certain amount of discipline, which is great. It enforces a certain amount of discipline even before you've set up centralized procurement, right? In the sense that, like, now you do have this schedule of licenses and subscriptions that are coming up for renewal. And so now automatically you're just like, okay, cool. Well, I have this service. I have these folks who can help me with this. Well, now we're 90 days ahead or 60 days ahead, right? Or 30 days ahead. Let's really, you know, reach out, crank it out, right? Let's set the context and start negotiating. And I actually do think, and this is maybe a word to our listeners, I mean, like tip number one is actually just start early. Right. If you give yourselves the benefit of time, whether you have Ramp Savings or the buyer team, right, or you just have an internal, you know, procurement function, starting early is probably just the single biggest tip. Right. Just give yourself time to actually go through the rigmarole, right, of contract negotiation. It's not that different than negotiating a debt facility, right, with, you know, one of our institutional lenders. Right. I think if you have time, I think then you will be able to rigorously and honestly, you know, go through and build these long-term partnerships. I think that's probably the biggest observation is don't leave anything to the last minute, right? And then obviously more time and more bandwidth always helps.
Yeah. I'm curious as well, like where on the price, because this is the challenge that we always see. It's like, you know, we know it's important, but we'll get to it later. Like, how do you think about prioritization in your finance org? Like if you were talking to another finance leader, where would you stack rank procurement versus, you know, the litany of other things?
I think it definitely varies. It varies depending on where we are during the year. There's some seasonality to it, right? Obviously, there's always going to be competing priorities, you know, inside the firm, right? You know, if we're out fundraising, right? If we need another debt facility, probably I'm going to be, you know, paying a lot more attention to that than you know, internal procurement. That being said, I actually do think that, and this is probably a good segue for us to talk about, you know, recession proofing in the face of 2022. But I will say that, you know, we now have much more of an imperative and much more focus, right, on driving efficiencies in operating expenses. And, you know, 2022 is a good reminder, I think, to everyone and all business leaders and finance leaders that times are not always going to be so good, right? Companies are not always going to be so flushed with cash. And it's a mission that I think we believed in since forever, right? But now more so than ever, there are these reminders from investors and from the markets, right? That, hey, you know, each dollar actually does matter, right? Figure out what your internal cost of capital is, figure out what your investment hurdle is, right? And make sure that internal projects and internal expenses exceed that investment hurdle, right? So I think it is situational dependent, right? Depending on the size of the company, depending on the stage, depending on the ticket size, right? Certainly that matters. But I think that over the course of this year, it's been shown in stark relief, right? That this is not something that you could just punt or, you know, ignore forever, right? This is something that persists over time.
Yeah. There, part of what you said on discipline, and I agree, that was my next segue on this, is I think there has been a lot of operating without discipline. Let's try 90 things. Let's see what happens. And your comment on enforcing discipline really matters. If you're going to do one thing, do it really well. And what is that thing going to be? And that thing should be generating cash. You know, given the cost of capital has increased dramatically, I think there should be an absolute focus for a lot of these businesses on, if not increasing the generation of cash, that should be the immediate near-term focus. I'm curious on the macro, like, you know, you have the interesting lens of the investor side as well as a core operator inside of Ramp. We've certainly felt the shift internally. Are you seeing the shift externally? Because I get a mix. Like, I'll talk to some companies and they're like, it's like pretty good, business as usual. And there's other companies who are really concerned.
I have. And I think what was interesting was, if you remember, right, a few weeks ago, we released our sort of inaugural pricing benchmark report, where we outlined how spend across the Ramp platform has evolved over time, and how that's evolved differently between segments. That's probably the most interesting observation, I would say. By and large, I think anecdotally, conversations with whether it's other CFOs or other, you know, investors or people who with a lot of different portfolio companies, I would say that this year has been sort of kind of a wild ride for a lot of people, and how people have reacted has been somewhat differentiated. For the most part, people are much more concerned with operating efficiency and garnering, you know, ever greater operating leverage, for sure, for a fact, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is there probably is a little bit of dispersion with respect to sort of recession calculus, right? Some people think it's coming. Other people think it might be over the horizon. Other people don't believe in it at all, right? And certainly you are going to react, right, differently depending on what you think about the macro environment. However, we can all agree, right, that inflation was high. Interest rates are increasing. Investments have slowed down, right? And so weighted average cost of capital should increase, right? And so what that's meant is, and I think this is probably categorically true, I think budgets have been cut, right? And how much so, again, depends. I think growth forecasts have definitely been cut across the board, across all different types of businesses. I don't care if it's services, manufacturing, SaaS, IT, healthcare. I think we've seen, you know, our fair share of customers in each of these segments, right? So I think growth forecasts have definitely come down. And I think in tandem, probably, you know, headcount planning has come down. And I think with respect to spend, right? And we saw this in our benchmark report. I think incrementally, companies are spending less money on advertising, right? And that's, you know, been shown sort of across the market, even outside the Ramp ecosystem as well. So I think that that's the challenge today, right? Is, and it's a question that, you know, on my team, we ask ourselves every day, which is, you know, if you had an extra dollar today, where would you invest it across the business? And if you had one fewer dollar, right, if you needed to cut, where's the first place that you would cut? I think, again, now more so than ever, business leaders are faced with that challenge. Whereas I think historically, right, maybe for the last two plus, you know, three plus years, folks really haven't had to think through that. But generally, I think one observation is probably that for better or for worse, or maybe just because they can be more nimble, I think across the SMB and lower middle market segments, you see a little bit more of sensitivity with respect to spend and OpEx. Whereas I think across enterprise customers, public companies, upper mid-market, we haven't seen as much volatility in spend and OpEx. And maybe that's just because, you know, rebudgeting takes a little bit longer, or maybe they just have larger war chests, right? And more liquidity. And so they haven't had to react as onerously. But that's one, you know, sort of observation we saw across our, you know, portfolio of customers.
I think on the spend report as well, one of the interesting things that I was paying attention to was the infrastructure costs. So if infrastructure costs are changing, if your AWS spend is way down, that means your actual product usage is down, as opposed to your growth. And I think largely it's increased, which means that while growth projections have been cut, companies are still growing. And again, on the SMB side, like it's pretty wavy. And on the enterprise side, it might be a little bit slower. But again, like, will these growth cuts impact infrastructure changes later? And so will we see an actual slowdown in product usage? Maybe. Maybe we haven't seen the effects yet. I liked your line on a dollar more or a dollar less. Where does this go? It reminds me of the Frank Slootman. If you have one thing to do, if you could focus on only one thing for the year, what would you do? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for companies to really internalize that and think through, if I have this $1 to spend, really being thoughtful about it versus just sort of, yeah, we should try these nine different initiatives and really go for it. It's a hard time. Hard times create great companies. And I think we've seen this over history.
It's definitely a very interesting, and yeah, it's a challenging environment for everyone, right? Clearly, this is one of those times where I think business leaders and founders are challenged, right? Because there's two things, right, at play. One is strategy, right? How good was your strategy, right? Before, you know, pre-2022, how good was your strategy? How good was your go-to-market function? How good was your R&D, right? Are you focused on the right things? And in theory, you know, if those things were correct and you had a good corporate strategy, you know, volatility in investment rates or hurdle rates shouldn't really impact that, right?
Yeah.
At the highest level, you know, there really shouldn't necessarily be large pivots in the business. Right. But certainly that deserves a little bit more scrutiny today. But I think the second thing that is challenging is I think there is now much greater focus on execution, right? Strategy is one thing. Now you have to be in the weeds, right? You have to really think about, you know, my goodness, we do have these 19 different experiments going on, right? And now we just, instead of picking the top 50%, we're just going to pick the top two to really double down on, right? And what are those two? And let's really go deep on these metrics. Let's really go deep on the data, right? And so now I think more so than ever, there is definitely pressure for folks to scrutinize and really go through in detail financial models, right? And very, very rigorously go through financial planning and be extremely detail oriented. I think that's going to make, you know, some people feel uncomfortable. It's going to make some people feel, you know, challenged. And in certain, you know, in certain instances, you know, there could be managers that feel like, well, now I'm being micromanaged by my boss, right? So that I think those are all things that, you know, we see and we hear about. And I think that is, you know, one of those things that, you know, again, it's tough times, right? They create great companies because these things are uncomfortable, right?
Yeah. I think the other point as well on just like the operating and being great at executing in the weeds, it's sort of unsexy and hard and just, you know, the blocking and tackling and doing the basics and just being relentless. I mean, complexity does not scale. Simplicity scales. I was reading the Sequoia deck, which I think there's just so many great lessons in there. But the whole time I was going through it, I was like, yep, this makes sense. This makes sense. This is fairly obvious. And if you find yourself saying it's fairly obvious, but not following through on your point on strategy, you've just missed a ton. And so I think the really back to basics, like how do we just build a great organization so we get everyone to buy in, it, even if they don't agree, disagree and commit and move forward as a team. I think that's super important. And then the other thing that comes to mind sort of just as an anecdote is I was thinking back to Patty McCord, who built the sort of like Netflix culture deck, like how do you build a great organization? And when you ask super high performing people in their organizations, what do you remember most fondly? No one said, you know, the massages, the ping pong tables, the happy hours. It was all, we rebuilt streaming infrastructure from the ground up because DVDs wouldn't scale. Or the hardest part of your professional life was the most enjoyable. And looking back on this, and I think, you know, part of this is there is more operating discipline. You need to really focus. It's you know, focus on making things simple and scalable. But also, like, this is a time for people who are really motivated to shine. And for the companies that really, really are great companies or angling to be great companies, this is the time. Go through the crucible and come out victorious.
Yeah, absolutely. It's tough, right? I mean, it also does mean, you know, some sacrifices, you're pulling down longer hours, et cetera. But, you know, again, I think the idea is that you're laying down the groundwork, hopefully, for a better business, a more sustainable business.
On the question of how do you create impact directly on the P&L for companies, I'm sure a lot of the listeners here would love to understand how you're thinking about this. I think it's very motivating. And, you know, some teams say, like, we don't share financials with our internals. Other teams are open book. We share everything. I think if there's one threat, like common thread across an employee is they really want to feel like their work matters. And especially in times now where creating impact on the actual business on a P&L is really going to matter. So I'm curious, how are you empowering or how are you even thinking about empowering teams? What tips would you give the listeners?
I think directionally speaking, we're probably on this side of the spectrum where we share quite a bit. Right. In the sense that, you know, internally, I think we do believe very strongly in, you know, building out in the open. I think we actually do share, you know, board presentations and financials with our employees. And certainly, you know, anyone on our team should feel very, you know, open reaching out to myself or anyone on my team. And I actually do think that that engenders, you know, a greater sense of ownership, right? And more alignment culturally. That being said, I think it also is very empowering just to say, hey guys, you know, what you're working on is very important. It contributes X percent to revenues. It contributes Y percent to contribution margin, right? And more importantly, if you can do this one thing to make this one metric 1% better, here's what our P&L is going to look like differently, right? 6 months from now, 12 months from now. We actually believe in very crisp, clearly conveying some of those deltas. Which, by the way, you know, we have, you know, a whole slew of internal presentations where we outline maybe four or five of these deltas where it's like a 1% change is this one metric results in X hundreds of thousands or millions, right, of additional P&L. And it's one thing that I think we're still, you know, it's still a work in progress, but that's one thing that I do actually believe in quite a bit in conveying that directly to different teams across the org.
Yeah, I mean, even pre-acquisition for my company, here's the monthly revenue, here's the customer CSATs, here's how we're doing, here's our burn, here's everything you need to know. I think it's really empowering to see. And I mean, you know, it's funny, making this more personal, we were talking about this last month. How does the savings team, as we grow, directly impact Ramp's business? And it's great. I mean, I think it's fantastic. And I would encourage other companies to, especially in times of strict discipline, really, really make sure that they're showing how each individual employee or teams directly impact the business.
Which, by the way, I think, you know, maybe this will be my last comment on this is, you know, obviously you and I both believe very strongly in this, but I think at some point you have to start with the basics, right? I think basic financial literacy probably is one thing also that we believe pretty strongly in. You know, you can't really come in and just start talking about EBITDA margins and free cash flow yields, right? With, you know, someone who's potentially fresh out of college in a different discipline, right? So I actually do think that, you know, the ability to have sort of additional transparency, a shared language, right, shared jargon does help, which is, you know, why a few months ago, right, I kind of led this whole like internal Econ 101 presentation, right, to sort of the whole company going through sort of the macro, the micro and whatnot. And that's something that I do strongly recommend to other finance leaders and other business leaders writ large, which is be transparent, make sure you're able to develop a shared vocabulary, right? If you do want to push P&L culture, make sure people actually know what P&L stands for, right? So I think that's just one, you know, tactical recommendation.
Yeah. And I mean, I can back this up both. The presentation was excellent. And you host weekly finance office hours, right? Open door, ask whatever you want, no question. And there are sticky questions that you answer. I mean, I'll sit in and there are questions that some people have that, you know, the strength of the business, what does this mean? I don't understand this. And really preaching that financial literacy, which I think goes a long way and empowers teams.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Kimya, it is now at the top of the hour. You've been really, really generous with your time. It's been great having you, you know, on the show and having you in this episode. It's been absolutely phenomenal just, you know, bantering with you and chatting about, you know, the buyer team, savings function, negotiations, and sort of the macro. It's been awesome.
Alex, this has been a ton of fun. I'm excited to see how the podcast unfolds. I'm going to be hosting a few episodes myself. And for the listeners, you'll hear a little bit more of my voice. But again, thank you for your time as well. I know you are incredibly busy.
Very good. Thank you so much. Recession Proof is brought to you by Ramp. To find out more about Ramp and how we can help you control spend, save time, and automate busy work, visit ramp.com. And then make sure to search for Recession Proof in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Ramp, thanks for listening.